This episode of Tales from Ostlantis is brought to you by Ostlantis Premium. Don't you just hate having your favorite podcast interrupted by ads like this? Well, dear listener, you're in luck. Because starting at just $3 a month, you can support independent Chicano media and receive ad-free episodes, premium episodes, bonus content, and access to our Discord server. Just visit talesfromostlantis.com and click Go Premium, or follow the link in the show notes. And now, on with the show.
You must excuse me. I've grown quite weary.
This hasn't been easy, I know. But you've learned a lesson. A lesson in honesty. Honesty to yourself and honesty to others. That lesson will stand you in good stead all your life.
I think we've all learned a good lesson. I've always heard that honesty is the best policy. Now I'm catching on to why that's so,
Gyalino Chimel, and welcome to Tales from Ostlantis, the show where we explore Mesoamerican pseudo-history, New Age nonsense, and other stories of adventure. We are your hosts, Curly Tlapoyawa.
And Ruben Arellano, also known as Tlacatecat.
Whether or not you have ever heard of Juan Luna Cárdenas before today, his influence on early Neo-Azteca nationalism is undeniable. He was, in essence, the father of the modern Mexicayot movement. Having influenced the likes of Rodolfo Nieva López and his MCRCA, along with countless others through his so-called teachings. Now, I say so-called not to be a hater, but because his alleged ancestral teachings are more a blend of pseudo-history, conspiracy thinking, and unfounded linguistic claims than anything rooted in factual information. These teachings have been adopted, repeated without question, and later distributed among participants of the early Chicano movement, especially those who were involved in Danza Azteca traditions. But his influence was certainly not limited to danzantes alone. In fact, Juan Luna even presented at a 1979 Knox conference in Colorado. On today's episode, we're going to delve into Juan Luna Cárdenas' personal history, his beliefs, and examine the influence he had on Chicano identity. So strap yourselves in as we present to you Juan Luna Cárdenas.
Juan Luna Cárdenas belonged to a small vanguard of Mexican indigenists who kick-started the Neo-Azteca movement in the aftermath of the Mexican Revolution. Sources indicate that by the late 1920s and early 30s, these Aztecas were promoting their ideology in and around Mexico City. Some of the things they promoted were the full immersion of Aztec thought and culture, the learning and teaching of Nahuatl, and importantly, the restoration of Aztec philosophy and spirituality. These indigenous groups were nationalist in nature and are now collectively referred to as belonging to El Movimiento de la Mexicanidad, or the Mexicanity Movement. As nationalists, they tended to be nativistic in nature and emphasized the recovery of the lost greatness of the Aztec Empire. Of this indigenous current, the leading Neo-Mexica organizations that emerged in the post-revolutionary era were the Sociedad Pro Lengua Nahuatl, or the Pro-Nahuatl Language Society, Azteca Tlamach Tlaca Wey Tlahuile, or the Great Light Aztec Union, Los Sacerdotes Autóctonos Que Residen en Texcoco, or the autochthonous priests who reside in Texcoco, the Wey Tlatecpanilistli Iknuki Aztecat, the Great Cultural Society of Aztec Friends, and also the Indigenous Confederation of Mexico. These last two were the most influential and are the ones that Luna really belonged to. I mean, he had a hand in all of them, but these are the ones that he really belonged to. And he held a position among the council of in the Confederation, the Indigenous Confederation, and was also the leader of the Aztec Friends Society. members of the organizations were encouraged to shed their non-indigenous names in favor of native ones, particularly Nahuatl. Luna took the name of Yaquini Mestli Cuauhtémoc Camo, Mestli being the Nahuatl term for Luna or Moon, which was his actual name. On a website dedicated to keeping the memory of Luna Cárdenas and the GCSAF, the Society of Aztec Friends, alive, his biographical page claims that he was originally baptized at the Templo de México de la Santa Iglesia Azteca, or the Mexican Temple of the Holy Aztec Church, where apparently he received his Nahuatl name. But due to religious persecution, his parents had changed it to Spanish. Luna Cárdenas claimed descent from Moctezuma and that he was heir to the throne of Mexico. The following is from that website.
He was born on March 30th, 1907, in the small town of Yautepec, in the present state of Morelos. His father was Zenon Luna N., native of the town of Ayutla, of the state of Guerrero. His mother was Felipa Cárdenas, of the small town of Yautepec, in the state of Morelos. On his father's side, he descended from Acual Metzli, or Ignacio Luna, the son of Cuaupopoca Metzli, the king of Coyoacan, who, then studying in the Imperial College of Tlatelolco from 1535 to 1540, married the imperial princess Matsayani Cuauhtémoc, the only daughter of the great emperor of Mexico, Tenochtitlan. His mother, whose Aztec name was Coyolcaltzin Camo, was the only descendant of the king of Yautepec.
Thus, Luna Cárdenas's royal lineage makes him out to be the heir of three seats, Coyoacan, Yautepec, and the great capital itself, Mexico Tenochtitlan.
Impressive.
Very. Congruent with that fantasy was the troublesome notion of purifying the Mexican nation once it was successfully restored. If there is an uneasy underlying tinge of racial extremism here, it is not by accident. The anthropologist Lina Odena Güemes, who did the first in-depth study of Nieva López's MCRCA, found that some of the members had racial supremacist inclinations. This sentiment was first espoused by Luna Cárdenas, who, as an engineering student in Germany in the 30s, adopted the idea of Aryan superiority, a notion he would later translate into that of Aztec greatness. Relating an interview of an MCRCA member, Odena Güemes informs us of this highly problematic discourse.
He gives great importance to the study of ethnic and racial phenomena and considers that the Jewish race is inferior inasmuch as the Nahuatl race belongs to the higher races. He often points out the similarity between the swastika and the Nahui Olin sign. He concludes that the power of the Aztecs was derived from the esoteric power of this sign, the same power contained in the swastika employed by Hitler. He knows in detail the Nuremberg trials, mentions them, and comments on the dates, the contents, the names of witnesses, etc.
That's something weird to be really geeked about.
Right? Hey, you guys, I know all about the Nuremberg trials.
Awkward. Hence, the Aztecs were equated with Aryans and imbued with mystical powers that were supposedly derived from symbols. We also see the beginning of the rhetorical development of Aztec greatness, perfection, and exceptionalism. Stressing this point, Odena Güemes cites examples throughout her study of the belief that among MCRCA members that ancient Anahuac civilization was the best at science, mathematics, botany, astronomy, and just about any other human concept imaginable. In another early study entitled The Truths of Others, an essay on nativistic intellectuals in Mexico, published in 1977 by Alicia Iwanska, she noted a contradiction with these Neo-Azteca Mexica groups. Whereas Western ideas were rejected, certain scientific principles were accepted when members believed that the ancient Nahuas had discovered them. For instance, when Iwanska interviewed some of the membership of the Movimiento Confederado, or the MCRCA, she was informed that the Nahuas had discovered the laws of evolution based on scientific deductions and predictions that had been practiced by teachers and students in the Calmeca, or the name for the University of Ancient Anahuac. Even today, you will find Mexicas proclaim that the ancestors knew about quantum physics, space travel, and atomic theory well before Western science discovered it. Thus, the supremacist rhetoric that was being espoused, along with the belief that ancient Nahuas possessed scientific knowledge that modern people are only now discovering, set the precedent for a Mexica exceptionalist ideology that is widespread among Neo-Mexicas today. This notion of being exceptional can also be gleaned by some of the names given to the Azteca organizations, like that of the Great Cultural Society of Aztec Friends, the GCSAF. This organization was headed by Luna Cárdenas, and it became the main arm of this emergent movement. Not long thereafter, Luna Cárdenas started publishing books on topics such as Nahuatl grammar and the Azteca, which were riddled with ethnocentric, pseudo-historical, and pseudo-scientific accounts of Aztec thought and culture. The GCSAF initially manifested itself as the Sociedad Limet, which was a sports and culture club founded in Mexico City on New Year's Day in 1922 by a group of young people who self-identified as Azteca, A-Z-T-E-K-A-H. It is the very first Neo-Mexica group that we have record of, and its original founding members identified themselves as Nahuatlatos, or native Nahuatl speakers, from the surrounding areas of Mexico City. From the start, the main objectives that the group outlined were the revitalization of the Nahuatl language and the restoration of Azteca culture. As part of this Azteca agenda, the society established the Azteca Tlatol Melahuacan, or the Aztec Language Academy, in 1925. 2 years later, in 1927, the Tlimet Society changed its name to the Great Cultural Society of Aztec Friends. It was run by Luna Cárdenas, and through him, they began proselytizing their Azteca doctrine in earnest. What scholars have found is that all the major Neo-Azteca Mexica groups have an origin myth that ties them to an elusive council of elders who were the keepers of traditional knowledge. In their origin myth, the GCSAF spoke of Zenon Luna, who was Juan Luna Cárdenas' father, as a great leader known as Tonalteuctli, or the Sun Lord. According to the group's legend, in 1920, Zenon Luna called a meeting, La Gran Junta de Ancianos Azteca, the Great Gathering of Aztec Elders, at a town called Ayutla de los Libres Guerrero. Apparently, the purpose of the meeting was to reorganize what they believed was millenarian Aztec knowledge and to prepare Juan Luna Cárdenas for his role as the leader of the Azteca movement, which was not quite the Neo-Mexica or the Mexicayot ideology that would later be promoted by Rodolfo Nieva López. But this is undoubtedly the beginning of that movement. For all intents and purposes, Juan Luna Cárdenas founded the modern Mexicayot movement, and all Azteca Mexica roads lead to him. Given his predilection for self-aggrandizement and historical fancy, one wonders how it was exactly that Luna Cárdenas was able to convince his original followers of his message, or that he was, as he believed, the heir to the throne of Mexico. Nonetheless, after many years of influence, his reputation and credibility started to crumble, especially after a regrettable incident that occurred in the Nahua community of Hueyapan. Odena Güemes recounts that unfortunate episode thusly.
Luna Cárdenas was the protagonist of a sad history in Hueyapan, in which the Nieva siblings disapproved of his conduct. A succinct narration of what is known and said in Hueyapan relates that some murals had been found in the vicinity of the town. When Juan Luna and his companions arrived at the place of discovery, the sky became cloudy and it began to rain torrentially. But it happened that the clouds opened, letting the rays of the sun bathe and crown only him. With his natural phenomenon on his side and his lineage unquestioned, he appeared to be enlightened. That occurrence was taken as a sign that a prince descended from the old Mexica nobility was to be born there. Thus, against her wishes, a maiden was ritually betrothed. Her disconsolate parents told us that this was how Prince Huitzi, a contraction of the name Huitzilihuit, or the king as they call him in the area, was born. Luna Cárdenas continued his restorative activities there, but his enthusiasm decreased over time. He stopped caring for the child and never returned to Hueyapan. The girl ended up having to leave the village because it was impossible to live in such a marked situation. That is so, so fucked up.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Have you picked up your Mexica calendar for the year 12 Flint? Or how about a paperback copy of The Four Disagreements? Just visit talesfromastlantis.com for all the latest merchandise and show some love for your favorite podcast. That's talesfromastlantis.com for all the latest merchandise. Now, back to the show.
To say the least. The reason why Luna Cárdenas was in Hueyapan to begin with can be traced to the early 50s when a gentleman from the community, Eliseo Cortez, reached out to him after learning of his organization and his efforts to restore Nahuatl. Luna Cárdenas was one among many at this time who was advocating for the revitalization of not just a pure form of Nahuatl, but he had also developed his own script where the letter C's were replaced by K's and the C cedilla with the squiggly line underneath was replaced by the CH as in chair. After first attending a language conference on Nahuatl called the Aztec Congress in 1939 and then meeting Luna Cárdenas in 1945, Cortés traveled to Mexico City with a few other villagers from Hueyapan to learn quote-unquote classical Nahuatl from him, sometime in the early 50s. Cortés befriended Luna Cárdenas and was his biggest supporter in Hueyapan. Sadly enough, the young girl chosen for the mating ritual described by Elena Güemes was none other than Cortés' own daughter. Before this life-changing moment in Cortés' life, his interest in language revitalization was spurred on by the arrival in the 40s of the Secretaría de Educación Pública and the Instituto Nacional Indigenista to Hueyapan. The purpose of these government agencies was to keep the Indians Indian by commercializing the concept of Mexico's indigenous heritage and to incorporate them ideologically, socially, and economically into post-revolutionary Mexico. The most indigenous the community looked, with culture, language, dress, the more funding it received. While doing their part in the government's social experiment, Cortés and a few other Hueyapeños learned from Luna Cárdenas that their local dialect of the Nahuatl language was completely inadequate. Luna Cárdenas's criticism held some authority since, as an early proponent of the orthographic change from the conventional to the more phonological structure during the Aztec Congress of 1939, others had followed suit. A case in point is that of Miguel Barrios Espinosa, who was educated as a teacher and worked with Robert Barlow, an American linguist, who trained him in linguistics and paid for all his publications, including the Mexicat y Tonalama in 1950 and other collection of poems in Nahuatl. He worked as an assistant for Barlow, collecting ethnographic and linguistic materials in different Nahuatl towns in the Valley of Mexico. The Mexicat y Tonalama was an all-Nahuatl periodical with a neo-Mexica message that operated independently of Luna Cárdenas but was likely influenced by his rhetoric. A good example of this influence is found in the following piece titled Mexicayot, or Mexicanus.
It appears that we, us, who are Mexicans, do not properly love our language. It appears that we are now ashamed to speak as Masehuales. It appears that our language makes us believe that we do not have the same worth among those other people who consider themselves civilized. Why should we feel ashamed because the Spaniards told us that we are worthless when they came here to Mexico and robbed the Mexican gold? The Spaniards want to eradicate our Mexicanness, and truly, they have already destroyed many things. And now, why should we let also our language be lost? Why should we allow this? Is that of no value which our ancestors created? How is this? Are we not Mexicans? The land on which we live is our property, our refuge, our dwelling place. May we protect our language. May we exalt our discourse among the other great nations. May we make our ceramic plates of many impressive colors. May we polish them with much craftsmanship and build our houses. The good things that we learned through the labor of our ancestors must not be forgotten. Let us do that which is proper for a Mexican. So in that way, Mexicanness will never be lost.
Sounds very familiar.
Right?
This restorationist message admonishing Mexicans for not embracing their Mexicanness is straight from Luna Cárdenas' playbook. He wrote extensively and published numerous books that advance his ethnocentric positions while attacking academics for incorrectly assessing the cultures of the continent, according to him. In the book Prehistoria de America, 1947, he explicitly accuses archaeologists of engaging in simple explorations and not making the proper connections to the prehistory of America.
Investigations have been developed in a field of prejudice. Researchers from all parts of the earth have spoken with their studies, and these studies have been published in a dispersed manner and completely diverge as to the standard of their conclusions. Nothing more could come from the tangle of wild ideas that have dominated over the peoples of our continent.
Casting doubt on the methods and conclusions made by mainstream scholars, Luna Cárdenas inserted his own pseudo-historical and pseudo-scientific interpretations that underscore most of his work. Perhaps the main revision that emerges is the idea that Mesoamerican cultures did not practice human sacrifice or anthropophagy. Luna Cárdenas made up things that were in direct contradiction to established knowledge, and these ideas would become Mexicayot doctrine.
Aztec hamburgers.
Dun, dun, dun.
One of Juan Luna's more notable claims is that the original name of the Americas is Ixachilan, a word he translates as immensity, and that the original inhabitants of this land mass are better known collectively as Ixachilanca, or people of Ixachilan. This claim has found its way into Danza Azteca circles, Chicano movement organizations, and even some Chicano studies programs. Hell, I even repeated this claim in my book, We Will Rise, a book I wrote as a young man who was heavily influenced by Mexicayot teachings at the time. Unfortunately, although to nobody's surprise, there is no record of this word having existed prior to Juan Luna introducing it in his book, Tratado de Etimologías de la Lengua Azteca, published in 1937. Basically, it looks like he just made it up. Juan Luna was also a staunch advocate of the idea that the indigenous people of the Americas did not migrate to these continents from elsewhere, but somehow evolved separately from the rest of humanity and had always been here. Another idea that is often repeated among followers of modern Mexicayot as well as other indigenous groups. Now, it's interesting that one of Juan Luna's stated goals was the teaching of a pure form of Nahuatl, uncorrupted by Spanish influence, because his analysis of many Nahuatl words are simply wrong and rooted in a fantastical revision of history. For example, in his book, Tratado de Etimologías de la Lengua Azteca, he proposes the following meaning for the word Azteca.
The Azteca voice is made up of the words AZ, as in Aztli, which means instrument or wing, and the ending Tecat, which means people or human group. Thus, Aztecat means the men of the instruments. That is to say, inventors of tools, or men of wings. It is understood that it was a flying device like a glider, a subject which Mr. Thompson wrote about several years ago, pointing to the Azteca as the inventors of the motorless airplane, something that has its direct origin in the game of the volador, or the flyer.
Right. In the 1970s, Juan Luna Cárdenas was given the opportunity to spread his teachings in the United States when he was invited to UT Austin as a visiting professor and Tinker Professor of Latin American Studies, an appointment that was considered controversial. And given his propensity for exaggeration, the controversy was well-deserved. We discussed Juan Luna's time at UT Austin in our interview with Juan Tejeda back in episode 5. And if you have not listened to this episode yet, I highly encourage you to do so. It's a fantastic interview with a super cool and interesting guy, and it provides a great look into the early Mexicayo influence on the Chicano movement in Texas. Now, in the February 14th, 1979 edition of the Corpus Christi Times, Juan Luna was interviewed by reporter Jesse Trevino. In the interview titled, "History Distorts Role of Aztecs, Professor Says Influence on World Vital," we get a glimpse into the pseudo-historical claims that Juan Luna was becoming known for. And these are direct quotes from this newspaper article. Luna said that there are names and inventions taken directly from the Aztecs for which history has given them no credit. The word Yankee, he said, is a derivative of the Aztec word Yanqui, which means new man or one that has just arrived. The word pants comes from the Aztec pantaloni, he said. And their popularity in European fashion had been introduced by the French Navy, which had seen the pantaloons in lands populated by the Aztecs. The word cotton was fashioned from the Aztec word for the shirt, alcoton and coton. The article then goes on to say, Luna ridiculed the idea that the inhabitants of the New World were descendants of nomadic tribes which had crossed the Bering Straits. There is no linguistic base for such a theory, but an economic one, he said.
Such authority.
Now, this brings me to my favorite claim made by Juan Luna Cárdenas, and that is the claim that the Aztecs invented hamburgers. Luna Cárdenas not only taught this as part of his classes at UT Austin, a fact attested to in our interview back in episode 5, but the claim also found a home in the academic paper Estudio Etimológico, Una Perspectiva Sociolingüística y Histórica del Habla Chicano by Arnoldo C. Vento. Now, it should be noted that Vento was deeply influenced by Juan Luna's teachings, and in fact, Vento had a hand in bringing Cárdenas to UT Austin. According to this paper, the Aztecs had invented hamburgers, as noted in the following quote.
Shall we call this imported North American product a hamburger? Or should we be purists and call them pacholas, since this Aztec dish was exported to Hamburg, Germany?
Okay, so I've looked into pacholas, and they exist. They're sort of a, they're like a ground hamburger meat. A ground beef tortilla is basically what a pachola is. They were invented in Jalisco, but they're not really well known throughout central Mexico. I've done a lot of research, and there's actually not a lot written about pacholas. They're also called pacholes. And I've put out the call to some historians of Mexican food
right.
to try to find out the origins of the pacholas because, you know, I don't want to flat out say that Juan Luna Cárdenas is just making this up again. But given his propensity to make things up, I will just say that I am highly skeptical that the Aztecs invented hamburgers.
It reminds me of the old meme.
Which one is that?
The Pulp Fiction.
Oh, yeah. You know what they call hamburgers in Mexico, Tenochtitlan?
No, what?
Pacholas with cheese. Now, look, I absolutely sympathize with Juan Luna Cárdenas's intentions of promoting the Nahuatl language and uplifting the cultural legacy of Mesoamerica. And in fact, I even agree with the headline from the Corpus Christi Times that history has distorted the role of the Aztecs. However, I just happen to completely disagree with his way of promoting our history and also with the actions he took in the pueblo of Hueyapan.
Oh, yeah.
We don't need pseudo-historical retellings of our past to make our history great. It's already great. And in the words of friend of the podcast, Juan Tejeda, just tell the truth.
Or make Aztecas great again.
So this guy, Juan Luna Cárdenas, first of all, it's a shame that he went to Hueyapan and did what he did in terms of, you know, taking that woman and creating this weird prophecy, I guess.
Was she a woman or was she still, by our standards?
Yeah, right. Exactly. So what he did was fucked up. Like, there's no way to excuse what he did.
Yeah.
That was horrible. What he did, and it's kind of reflective of just kind of what happens in the Mexicayo community where we have these so-called elders that are just not being held accountable for actions.
Exactly.
And their behavior towards young women. And that's something that we really need to address. Yeah, this is something that needs to get dealt with. But then also the way that he told them, like, you know, the way you speak Nahuatl is inadequate.
Very condescending.
Right? Because it's not the pure Nahuatl that I speak.
It's not the classic Nahuatl.
Yeah. And this, I see this actually happen a lot. Like, this is an attitude that gets carried over by a lot of the followers of the Mexicayot, where they want to study quote-unquote classical Nahuatl, and they kind of look down on the Nahuatl spoken by modern speakers in indigenous communities as if it's a lesser-than version. And, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I always defer to modern speakers of the language. When I want to know something about the language, then I always ask my friends who are modern speakers. And, you know, because I study Nahuatl because I want to be able to have conversations with people. I want to be able to talk to people. And that's not going to happen if you study classical, quote-unquote classical Nahuatl. I mean, classical Nahuatl has its place if you want to do studies of historical documents and paleography and stuff. But, you know, to be so dismissive of the Nahuatl being spoken by modern speakers, that's just, I mean, it's condescending and it's a colonialist attitude.
Right. I was going to say it's very Eurocentric because it's almost like taking the approach that Latinists take with, you know, the pure form of classical Latin, right? Like there's a classical Latin that is a standard for classical studies and everything else is considered vulgar Latin or some other derivation of Latin or the Romance languages derived from Latin. So it's kind of like along those same sort of, you know, Eurocentric ideas of what is pure and what is not, right? So for someone who advocated for the purity of the Aztecs and for the rejection of Eurocentricity, even though he might not have called it that, but that's what he was doing. It seems very Eurocentric of him to go to someone's community and, you know, tell them that the way they speak their own tongue as it's evolved over the centuries is not the correct form just because he happens to disagree with it or because he has his own purist notion of what Nahuatl should be.
Yeah, it's a shitty attitude to take. There's no way to get around that. You know?
And unfortunately, it's influenced a lot of Mexicayot because, you know, most of us, I mean, I didn't grow up speaking Nahuatl. You know, I was exposed to it in my dad's hometown in Mexico. When I would visit, when I was a kid, I would hear people speaking various indigenous languages. One of them was Nahuatl. And I was always curious about that, but no one in my family spoke it. And as Chicanos, you know, growing up here in the United States, and, you know, as we've tried to, you know, go back and reclaim our indigenous identity at various points, you know, most of us have tried to learn some form of Nahuatl, you know, basic words to try to communicate, you know, Notoka, Tlacateca, Ni, Mexica, you know, Mexica Tiawi, you know, the basic things, right? And we think that we're learning a unfiltered language that has been passed down through the tradition, when in fact it's even if it's just relegated to Mexicayot, if we just strictly look at it from a Mexicayot sense, even that it has its own problems in terms of the Nahuatl language that we've been exposed to, you know, through the tradition. Because, I mean, I think you are one of the people that have told me that you've gone down to communities in Mexico and you try to talk Nahuatl to them based on what you've learned, and they kind of give you these, you know, quizzical looks like, I mean, they understand what you're saying, but they're like, that's not really how we say it. There's this disconnect, right?
Yeah, and that was one of the first things that I learned when I went down to visit Nahuatl speaking communities, was the Nahuatl that I was learning was at, you know, through the Mexicayot,
right,
was not really the way that it was spoken. So it was eye opening, but it was also super helpful, because what that did was it prompted me to engage and connect with native speakers and actually, you know, start developing an understanding of the way that Nahuatl spoken. And it remains, you know, the largest indigenous language spoken in Mexico. There's close to 2 million.
2 million. Wasn't it like 3 million at one point? Or is it, am I misremembering?
I don't think so. I think you might be remembering that wrong. It's like 1.7 something. So it's not quite 2 million. But they also undercount indigenous communities.
Right.
So it's considered to be around 2 million indigenous speakers, and there's a wide variety of variants of the Nahuatl language that are spoken. There's a wide variety of ways of spelling words in Nahuatl. There's not like a set standard orthography, although many organizations have tried. But
well, if you go to like Wikipedia, the Nahuatl Wikipedia page, a lot of the orthography for the language seems to reflect a lot of the changes that were being advocated by people like Luna Cárdenas through the Aztec Congress and these other various Nahuatl organizations. So some of that has actually been adopted in a more generic sense by Nahuatl-speaking peoples, because it makes sense phonetically to spell words a certain way instead of convoluting it with different, you know, European versions of sounds that don't really translate to Nahuatl, right? That's where you get these different spellings for the same word in a lot of the colonial texts, and people get confused if they're referring to the same thing or if it's something different because there's various spellings. But if you sound it out as you're reading it, you'll notice that it's the same word, it's spelled differently.
Yeah, and I think the newest iteration of the orthography that's been proposed by Inali, and I forget what Inali stands for, but they use the K, they use a W, which is something that I've always I've always been the advocate of using the W.
You're not writing Nahuatl correctly.
Right? And so they use the W, and one of my favorite quotes regarding, you know, spelling Nahuatl differently comes from that that newspaper we were just talking about,
right.
The Mexicat y Tonalama. A gentleman, I can't remember his name, but he says, you know, Inin totlachtol oxe tleika tikikwiloske keman kastilan, which means, you know, this language is ours. Why should we write it as if it were Spanish? Why should we write it as if it were Castilian? And so the adoption of the W, of the K, of the Z, and so forth are seen as part of a decolonial process of resistance of indigenous communities saying, well, we're going to write this way. We're not going to write it as if we're using the Spanish language to filter our language through. We're going to write words the way that we choose to. So that's something that I could respect.
What about this idea, though? I mean, a lot of the words like Mexica, the way we spell it with a K, or using the W, if you look at German, for example, when or I'm not sure if it's German or some other European language from that area, if you read when they spell out Mexico and things related to Mexico, they use the K and they use the W. So I wonder, since Luna Cárdenas spent time in Germany, if he maybe absorbed some of that picked up on it and thought to himself, you know, this probably makes more sense in the way we spell it in Mexico, and decided to bring that idea back with him. And when he began to advocate for the redefinition of how you spell Nahuatl.
Yeah, that could be. That's an interesting hypothesis, Dr. Arellano. There's your next paper.
Right. No, that's Magnus's paper. I'm not a linguist.
Yeah. And one thing that I do want to touch on, though, that Luna Cárdenas promoted and which has been picked up by, you know, people in the Mexicayot as well as other indigenous groups. I'm not saying that it comes from Juan Luna Cárdenas, but, you know, he's one of the people that promoted this idea, was that, you know, inhabitants of the Americas are from here, that we didn't come over through the Bering Strait, and that life evolved here separately. And I mean, as an archaeologist, I could tell you that the preponderance of evidence
right
points to that not being the case, right? That we did not evolve here separately from the rest of humanity, that, you know, racially, archaeologically, genetically, you know, through the flora and the fauna, like, we can trace the people's migration into what we now call the Americas. And this need to challenge that idea really puzzles me, because everybody came from somewhere, and it doesn't make us any less indigenous, right? I think that's where it comes from, this
it
sense
does.
That, well, if we say we came from somewhere else, it discounts our indigeneity and means that we're not the true original people of this land. But, I mean, everybody came from somewhere. I mean, even if you look at Japan, I think Japan has been shown to be occupied for about 35,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the Japanese are sweating it. Like, you know, we are less Japanese because we've only been here 35,000 years.
Well, I think the difference is that the Japanese aren't colonized by a European power.
Yeah.
And that's the key in this conversation, is that people, not only do they say these things because, I mean, Luna Cárdenas wasn't the first person to say this.
Yeah.
But it comes from this idea that a lot of indigenous, you know, people have in terms of their cultural understanding of who they are as a people, where they come from, and it's tied to their identity and origins of, and tied to the land, which is a completely different conversation, which we're not here to critique that or anything, but that's, you know, that's my understanding of where this idea comes from, that we are people of this land and we emerged from this land, whether it was from the land itself, whether it was from a lake, or from a spring,
a cave,
or a rock. However that specific, you know, indigenous culture has decided, you know, culturally speaking, through generations to describe their place in the world. that's separate from, you know, that's more of a sort of spiritual religious understanding that's tied to culture, right? That that doesn't necessarily mean that scientifically speaking, because you produce evidence showing that that's not the case, that somehow you're discrediting that interpretation. That's the cultural thing. You know, you can have, if you wanted to, if you're this individual that accepts both worldviews, the one doesn't have to negate the other, because one is a social, cultural, spiritual understanding of yourself and your place in that society, and the other one is scientific, that has nothing to do with whether or not you're a Western or a Eurocentric or whatever. It's just scientific, right, at this point, to say that science is controlled by one space as opposed to a different space is denying the fact that our own ancestors were scientists, right? So don't give science, don't give Europeans and Westerners the credit for being scientists and being scientific when our own people were scientists and scientific. It's just
corn doesn't just come out of nowhere,
right? And so, you know, what he was doing, it's also kind of similar to what Vine Deloria Jr. was doing too in some of his work, and this, there's a term for this, and it's not meant to be derisive, and I know some people might take it that way, but it's called native creationism, right? Kind of like Christian creationism, where, you know, it's believed that the earth is only a certain age, and, you know, there's a lot of other beliefs that you know are extracted from that core idea. It's different, it's not the same belief, but it has the same underlying basis that, you know, that people were born from a certain place, that were created in that space, instead of allowing for the fact, as you were saying, that you could have immigrated here from somewhere else, your ancestors, right, 30, 40, however many years ago that was. It doesn't make you any less indigenous, although the argument being that if we say that we're not indigenous to the land, then xenophobic, racist, nativists are going to try to say, well, see, everyone's an immigrant, so you don't get anything. We don't deserve, or you don't deserve to get anything from us. Who, you know, it's all, we're all immigrants, yada yada yada, and so I get the resistance and the pushback against accepting scientific facts on this. I get it.
Yeah, I get it too. But I always try to point out to people, like, you know, the racists, they're always going to have a reason to hate.
Oh, yeah.
Whether
absolutely,
it doesn't matter whether, you know, our ancestors got here 10, 15, 20,000 years ago, that's irrelevant to the worldview that they're pushing. And like you were saying, you know, when your people say, yeah, our ancestors say we came from those mountains over there, and it's meaningful to you, and it helps describe your place on that landscape and culturally, those are all beautiful things, but they are not, you know, erased. By acknowledging, like, well, yeah, and then also we can show that our ancestors, because to me, the fact that our ancestors came through Beringia, whether you think that they came down through the ice free corridor, or if you follow the kelp highway hypothesis, that they came down the coastline on boats, both of those things require that they came over Beringia. And the fact that they did that, hunting Pleistocene megafauna, right? I don't know if you know how big a cave bear or a giant sloth or a mammoth is, but these people were hardy, rugged, badass individuals who braved the unknown, man. And they came across and they did spectacular things. And then they gave rise to these civilizations.
Right.
On this land that nobody had ever been to before. That's beautiful to me.
It is. That's a beautiful story.
Our ancestors were legit. And to just discount that and be like, nah, that's the white man science that says that. It's like, wow, how disrespectful to that journey that our ancestors made and the hardship that they went through. Because
the resiliency, I mean, like you were saying, to produce these cultures and civilizations throughout the Americas. It's something to be, you know, proud of, you know?
Exactly. And I always like, honor that journey, man. Honor the journey that our ancestors took, because that was some hardcore shit. that they were some badass individuals. And I think one thing that our people, and I think people in general, get confused with, I'm going to put on my science hat here real quick, is they confuse Beringia, the Bering Strait, right, with the ice-free corridor, mm-hmm, when it's actually two separate things. Like, people crossed Beringia, got to Alaska, and then they were stopped by these giant mountains of these walls of ice, basically. If you've seen Game of Thrones, that's basically what these things look like. And then after crossing Beringia into what is now the Americas and waiting there, you know, some people think they didn't wait. Some people think they jumped on boats, mm-hmm, and came down the coastline. Eventually, these ice sheets receded and created an ice-free corridor that allowed them to walk down through. And there's different hypotheses, right? Like, we know that our people came from what is now, you know, Siberia, basically. But we don't know. There's still discussion being had on which specific route did they take once they got to Alaska. Like, did they go down through the ice-free corridor? Did they come down the coastline? Did they do both? Was, mm-hmm, done in multiple waves? And these are questions that we're still trying to answer. But that's the beautiful thing about science, right? Is that as we get better and better data, our understanding increases and we're able to have a more fully developed perspective of what our ancestors went through.
But the better question is, when those ancestors were making those early migrations, did they arrive at America or was it Ixachilan?
What's funny with that word is, because I bought into it, you know, I was a hardcore Mexicayo promoter. I wrote a book when I was young.
You wrote the book, man.
That fully, you know, promoted these ideas. When I lived in Mexico and I came back to the United States, like, the people in the Mexicayo told me, like, it's your responsibility now. When you go back, your responsibility is to spread Mexicayo. And I took that very seriously.
Right.
Because
I remember you telling me that stuff back then. Yeah.
I was a hardcore soldier, you know? And then, you know, you get older and start learning more things, start questioning things. And it's like, maybe.
You're supposed to keep the same train of thought for 50, 60 years, Curly, didn't you know? You're not supposed to change your mind ever.
Right? That's Western.
That's Western, exactly.
Well, you know what I like to say, my friend? The truth, it's like medicine. It don't always taste good, but it's always good for you.
Time for some pacholas.
Timoitase. Thank you for listening to Tales from Aztlantis, a project of the Chimali Institute of Mesoamerican Arts. If you enjoy the show, please consider becoming a Patreon supporter. You can do this by visiting talesfromaztlantis.com and clicking Support the Podcast. Your continued support will help keep the podcast ad-free and independent. Until next time, Timoitase.